Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Friday, August 25th, 2017. Japan's permanent representative to the United Nations urges the South Sudan government to respect the UN-backed Regional Protection Force.
We strongly urge the government's full cooperation with AMIS, including on the completion of the RPF's deployment and its effective operation, as stipulated in the unanimously adopted Security Council Resolution 2327.
And Ugandan businesses near the border with South Sudan is destroyed by flood.
We lost our batteries. They went with water. Big scam batteries, around 3 of them went. Mobile phones, we lost some. We lost accessories. Our accountability books, they all went. Receipts of our suppliers.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A top United Nations peacekeeping official is calling on South Sudanese leaders to show genuine political will to achieve lasting peace. Assistant Secretary General for UN Peacekeeping Operation El Kassim Wani told Security Council on Thursday that the conflict in South Sudan is man-made.
For which the leaders of South Sudan bear a responsibility, a direct one. The dire economic situation and continued conflict in the country have combined to create a dangerous and precarious situation for its citizens. But the same leaders can also bring the country back from the impending abyss.
El Kassim also said it is critical that the leaders of South Sudan listen to the international community. The UN Special Envoy for South Sudan, Nicholas Haysom, addressed the council via a video link from Addis Ababa. He reminded observers that there have been at least 5 political initiatives in just last few months. None of them are fruitful. He said, Kenya's president-elect Uhuru Kenyatta is just one of the handful of leaders who has tried to bring peace to South Sudan.
With the Kenyan government focused on the outcome of recent elections and the former detainees who were a driving force behind this initiative, preoccupied with their Kampala discussions, the initiative appears to be stalled.
In July, President Salva Kiir and Rebecca Nyandeng de Mabior met in Entebbe, Uganda. Reports say President Kiir and Nyandeng reaffirmed their commitment to reunify the SPLM and stabilize the country's political landscape. Haysom says this has also fizzled.
This agreement concerned a resolution of SPLM intra-party problems. With the continued absence of Mishar's opposition faction and some amongst the former detainees group reluctant to reconcile with President Kiir in such a manner, the Ugandan initiative continues to fall short of achieving its goal.
A ceasefire declared by President Kiir in May has not held. This month, fighting erupted in Pagak, an opposition stronghold between government and rebel forces. Government soldiers claim to have taken control of the village. In June, IGAD announced a high-level revitalization forum of the parties to the 2015 peace agreement, including what they call estranged groups. Planning for the forum is underway. Some observers worry this could be another dead end for the country. But Haysom told council members from the forum is beginning to gain momentum.
Irrespective of his declared commitment made to the IGAD Council of Ministers during their Juba visit to implement IGAD summit decisions, President Kiir continues to prioritize the national dialogue and the reunification of the SPLM, which he recently stressed would bring peace, with a revitalization process playing only a supplementary role.
Amid broken promises and slow progress on commitment is the conflict that has torn the country's social fabric, leaving more than half of the country's residents in need of assistance for basic needs. Last week, the South Sudan government refused to grant landing and takeoff permits to planes with the United Nations mission in South Sudan. Government spokesman and Information Minister Michael Makui told this program the government is unhappy with the deployment of UN-backed Regional Protection Force near the airport.
In the first contingent, the force, the advanced team of the Nepalese and the Bangladeshis, and came and they put up there. And now we don't know as to why did they decide to go to the airport site.
Japan's permanent representative to the United Nations, Koro Beso, told Security Council members that South Sudan's government should prove it respects the agreements it has signed with the international community.
It is regrettable that violations of the status of forces agreement occurred this month regarding flight clearance for AMIS personnel.
Beso says the Kiir administration has an obligation to facilitate the work of humanitarian groups in South Sudan. He says the government of South Sudan should fulfill its promises to the international community.
In a meeting this week with the diplomatic corps in Juba, the government again announced a policy of cooperation on AMIS activities, including the deployment of the RPF. Concrete actions must follow.
But Makwe insists the government of South Sudan is in charge of the country and should not be directed by the international community.
If you are a guest coming to my house, you are supposed to ask me where you will put up, but you don't come and choose where to put up or where to sleep. Even in a hotel, you don't just move into rooms, but you check in so that you are given your room, you are shown your room.
The Japanese envoy to the United Nations says the government of South Sudan should not be allowed to renege on agreements Juba signed with the United Nations.
We strongly urge the government's full cooperation with AMIS, including on the completion of the RPF's deployment and its effective operation as stipulated in the unanimously adopted Security Council Resolution 2327.
That UN resolution extended the mandate of the United Nations mission in South Sudan to December 2017, and it gave UNMISS additional powers to protect civilians while the Security Council considers sanctions against individuals whose actions undermine peace, stability and security in South Sudan. The transitional period of the South Sudan peace agreement expires in few months' time, but several key provisions of the deal, including the integration of forces into one unified command, have not materialized. JMAC says little has been achieved and the government lays blames for failing to fulfill the agreement on the international community. Waki Simon Wudu compiles this report for VOA from Juba.
South Sudan government spokesman Michael Makwe insists that the government is moving well on implementing the peace agreement, even though Festus Muhai, the head of the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, JMEC, strongly disputed that claim in a speech just yesterday to the UN Security Council.
From day one, we have had to persuade the parties to implement each and every task. Disagreements between the key principals and the lack of any appetite for compromise slowed progress to a standstill and led to a growing tension in Juba that ultimately resulted in the violence of July 2016.
Mohai and others have noted that provisions such as the preparation for the national elections and the integration of government and rebel forces into one unified command have yet to take place. The 2015 peace agreement requires that not later than 6 months after the signing, a National Election Commission be reconstituted. 18 months after its signing, the deal requires that the government and the opposition integrate all their forces into one unified command. So far, neither of those things have happened. Makwe acknowledged in an exclusive interview with the South Sudan in Focus on Monday that some of the deal's provisions have yet to be implemented.
We have reservations because there are some provisions that we did not want. So we wrote them down, and those provisions are there. These are part of the reservations in which we had. There is no way you would come and legislate for me, or you come and bring somebody. We have been legislators. What is that which brings that doubt of bringing in a foreigner to come and sit on our drafting body so that they draft laws for us?
Makwe is referring to the National Constitution Amendment Committee. Makwe blames the committee for failing to draft a law which sets up procedures for the national elections. President Kiir and members of his SPLM ruling party have objected to the government's power-sharing ratio announced by IGAD. The government has also expressed its reservations over the redeployment of the National Army outside the capital, Juba. Makwe accused the international community and IGAD of failing to live up to their obligations.
The international community that came in to push for this agreement with all these provisions, some of which we stood against but were imposed on us, they promised that they will fund this project. We have been telling them that we have no money. The government of South Sudan doesn't have money.
International partners, including the U.S., Japan, and Germany, have said both parties have failed to fully implement the agreement or respect the cessation of hostilities permanent ceasefire. Makwe complains that the monitoring body, JEMEC, has been given too much power.
This agreement says if you sit as a cabinet and you pass your resolution by 2/3 majority as required, and you pass amendment of any provisions of the agreement, that decision will then go to the JEMEC. And JEMEC must pass it by 2/3 majority, after which it will go to the parliament. If JEMEC doesn't pass it, it is gone, which means that it has the authority, it has the power to overrule decisions of the cabinet.
South Sudan in Focus reached out to JEMEC Communications Officer Richard Bailey for the past 3 days for a comment. In an email response, Bailey said he is too busy to respond. Mohai said both sides have failed to live up to their promises.
We as JEMEC have remained profoundly shocked by the rampant hostilities across the country and the rapid deterioration of the political, security, humanitarian, and economic situation in South Sudan.
A report released last week by South Sudanese activists said that as the transition period for the agreement approaches its expiration in 6 months, it is clear that peace and stability have not been achieved. Mohai told the UN Security Council the revitalization process will only work if the warring parties offer more than a lip service to resolve the conflict.
There is need for demonstrable political will by the parties and the estranged groups to be inclusive and to accommodate one another politically rather than defeat each other militarily.
The transitional period expires in about 6 months from now. Under the peace deal, national elections are to be held in 2018. For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, the number of street children is increasing in Juba. Find out more when we come back.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
do you believe that traditional leaders and elders have a place in today's society? Why or why not?
I believe that they do have a very, very significant place in what we stand for today. You know, they are a reflection of the values that we stand for. And so their input is very relevant, so that we don't lose out on our values.
I don't think they have space. According to me, no. To some extent, I really don't think they should be there because times have changed and because they're traditional, they keep taking us back.
Yeah, elders, they have a place in the society, but development is coming with a lot of challenges on elderly people, where you see young educated people no longer respecting them as it used to be in the past.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Business owners in the Ugandan town of Elegu on the border with South Sudan are still counting their losses 3 days after torrential rains caused River Ayama to burst its banks, flooding the entire area. Ugandan officials say the flood has destroyed houses and businesses. Simon Peter Apiku has more for VOA from Elegu, northern Uganda.
The flooding was sudden, fierce, and merciless, according to residents of Elegu. The rushing water came from the north and swept across the town in minutes, clearing everything in its path as it moved toward South Sudan. Buildings owned by Ugandans and South Sudanese collapsed as the water inundated land and property. For the past decade, floods have hit the same area every couple of years and at roughly the same time of year. Elegu businessman Mansour Noor says the floods were bad in 2011, 2013 and 2015, but this week's floods were the most aggressive.
This one has been the worst flood ever. From these years I've been mentioning, this one has been the worst.
Business owners saw their merchandise disappear as flood waters quickly submerged their stores and shops. Local traders say the floods carried away power generators, deep freezers, computers, and solar batteries. The Elegu police station, immigration offices, and the Uganda Revenue Authority office were all flooded. The flooding caused authorities to briefly suspend work at the border. Mansour Noor says people were forced to evacuate in the middle of the night.
The lodges, people could not even sleep in their lodges. There are some few, 2 to 3 storage houses around here that helped people. People climbed up on unfinished buildings and they slept there.
Simon Peter Mutebi sells mostly electronics at his shop in Elegu. He says he lost everything.
We lost our batteries. They went with water. Big scam batteries, around 3 of them went. Mobile phones, we lost some. We lost accessories. Our books, accountability books, they all went. Receipts of our suppliers, they all went.
Namugema Jamawa sells construction materials such as corrugated iron sheets, nails, cement, and limestone. Jamawa says she received an order of 640 bags of cement the day before the floods hit. She sold only 2 bags on Monday, the day before the floods came. The rest, Jamawa says, were submerged in flood water.
Which means it was 638 bags. Limestone, it could be something of 200, because now I don't know what is exactly there.
As the floods approached, Jamawa tried to erect a barrier around the perimeter of her store, but says the force of the water was just too strong.
We had no any idea to prevent that water. It was too much, too much.
Elegu resident Alex Chibule says residents stood by, helpless, as the water cut through the town and surrounding villages.
The situation was not good. People were just sleeping here. We are just here. Others were there, down there. Snake, together with the snakes, what, everything.
Local officials have asked police marines to assist in the rescue effort and search for any missing persons. Kasim Akule, chairperson for Elegu's Zone 2, one of the hardest hit areas, says workers rescued a number of people who were stuck, including a family that was missing for nearly 20 hours.
One child of 1 month, plus the mother, and a 13 young girl. And those people, they were rescued by God, actually. They clamped on Ant Hill, then yesterday morning we recovered them.
Akule confirmed thousands of homes have been destroyed.
I'm still planning to go into the deep, into those areas to cover everything. But right now, which I have covered, it is 3,500 houses which is destroyed by the water.
Akule estimates damages to be around 2 billion Ugandan shillings. Several South Sudanese traders were also affected. Many South Sudanese own businesses along the Elegu Adjumani Road, one of the worst places affected by the floods. Trucks loaded down with much-needed goods headed for South Sudan were unable to cross the border due to the flooding. For VOA News, I am Simon Peter Piku in Elegu.
A local non-governmental organization in Juba says the nearly 4-year-old conflict has forced more than 2,000 children to beg for food or money on the streets of the capital. A group calling itself the Christian Agency for Development says most of the children were separated from their families after fighting broke out in their villages. As we hear from Michael Atit in Juba, some children say they came as far as Kapoita in the former Eastern Equatoria State.
15-year-old Martin says when violence broke out in Kapoita last year, he separated from his parents and never saw them again. While fleeing Kapoita, he met a truck driver who helped him come to Juba. Speaking in Arabic, Martin says he met other young people in Konyokonyo Market and liked them. Now, picks food from garbage bins or eats leftovers from Juba restaurants.
Here sometimes we collect garbage, crystals, and we get some little money. We buy some food and jointly eat together because it's not good to eat alone.
Martin says living on the street has taught him to peacefully coexist with other kids regardless of their ethnic backgrounds. He says for the past several months, Juba Street have become his home. Martin says another street kid who hails from his home village told him that his father was killed during last year fighting in Kapoita. 11-year-old James says he got separated from his parents when fighting flared up in Juba in July last year when government forces battled soldiers loyal to former First Vice President Riek Machar. He says his parents fled the Haigem area near the presidential palace where all of the shooting started. James says after being separated from his family, he began to beg for money and food in Juba's Melekia area. Speaking in Arabic, he says sometimes he washes people's cars for money to buy food, but it is not enough to survive.
We have learned how to smoke and take other substances. Sometimes police don't allow us to enter to some places. They beat us. And some elders also threaten us and can pick whatever you have in your hand.
A local NGO called Minds and Souls Institute, together with the NGO Christian Agency for Development, conducted an assessment recently and learned that more than 2,000 children lived on Juba Street. Their survey found that about 60% of kids living on the street fled their homes due to the conflict. On Thursday, the NGO gathered up to 125 street children from Juba's Melekia area and gave them clothes and food. They also treated about half of the children who had various injuries. Peter Malir, executive director for Christian Agency for Development, says due to deteriorating economic and humanitarian conditions in South Sudan, many families can no longer feed their children.
Number of parents have died in the conflict. Number of parents have lost their economic life survival. And these hands have affected number of these children. So we have realized that as much as we are sitting as citizens of this country, part of our country is breaking away.
Unless the fighting ends soon, Malir warns, children living on the streets will adopt lawlessness and could become a security threat in the future. Aside from devastating South Sudan economy, Malir says, the ongoing conflict has torn apart the country's social fabric.
Our communities are broken apart because of this war. When we are talking of peace, we don't talk of peace when our children are on the road. We don't talk of peace when our women are on the road. We don't talk of peace when the vulnerable people are begging on the road. No care, no attention.
Ugo Aurelio Sichim, Director General for Jubeke State Ministry of Information, Youth and Sports, praised the Christian Agency for Development for helping Juba Street children, but says state and national officials should do more to get children off the streets.
These are their children. These are their concern. You cannot leave your children just sleeping on the streets with wounds. They say there is a Minister of Health. Which type of health are you treating people?
Malir says his NGO hopes to open a home for street children in the near future so they can be provided with psychosocial support and vocational training. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here is some of our top stories with Carol Van Damme.
Thanks, John. Warring parties have been fighting in South Sudan for nearly 4 years now. A top UN peacekeeping official marked the occasion with a call to the country's leaders to show genuine political will to achieve lasting peace, telling the UN Security Council yesterday that those who sparked the conflict can be the ones who resolve it. Assistant Secretary General for Peacekeeping El Gassim Wayne told the council that the conflict is man-made, for which the leaders of South Sudan bear a direct responsibility to bring the country back from what he called the impending abyss. Al-Ghassim also said South Sudan's leaders must hear a unified demand from the international community of what is expected of them. Nicholas Haysom, the UN Secretary General's envoy for Sudan and South Sudan, reminded observers that there's been at least 5 initiatives in the last few months alone and that none of them have worked so far. Last week, South Sudanese government officials refused to grant landing and takeoff permits to planes operated by the United Nations mission in South Sudan. Government spokesman and information minister Michael McQuay told this program that the government is unhappy with the deployment of the UN-backed regional protection force near the international airport in Juba. The Japanese permanent representative to the United Nations, Koro Besho, told Security Council members that the South Sudan government should prove it respects agreements it signs with the international community. And finally, business owners in the Ugandan town of Elegu, near the border with South Sudan, say flooding has destroyed their property. The losses have come from the flooding of the river Anyama to where it burst its banks, flooding the entire area this week. Officials say the flood destroyed many houses and cost businesses billions of Ugandan shillings in losses. The flooding on Tuesday was sudden, fierce, and merciless, according to residents. The rushing water came from the north and swept across the town in minutes, clearing everything in its path as it moved toward South Sudan. Buildings owned by Ugandans and South Sudanese collapsed as the water inundated land and property. For the past decade, floods have hit the same area every couple of years and at roughly the same time of year. Elegu businessman Mansour Noor says the floods were bad in 2011, 2013, and again in 2015. But this week's floods, according to him, were the worst. Business owners saw their merchandise disappear as floodwaters quickly submerged their stores and shops. Local traders say the floods carried away power generators, deep freezers, computers, solar batteries, and more. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Damme.
That's our show for this Friday. We now leave you with the song Alamis Sudan by Mo Attack Mo. I've been listening to Mo Attack Mo with the song Alamis Sudan. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Would like to hear your feedback. Our email is southsudan@voanews.com. You can also find us on our Facebook page, South Sudan in Focus. You have a peaceful weekend and join us on Monday for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.